Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark, and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm fine, Alex. And how are you on this very special day? Another year more radiant.
It is it is my birthday today.
Isn't that so? Listeners, Alex's her devotion to literature and the TLS knows no bounds. So she's working on her birthday. So
I am, but this isn't
extra
work.
Props and cheers.
This is just talking to you and to our very special guests. This feels like a treat. But I've also celebrated my birthday slightly over the long weekend by, I have to tell you this because it's just I just have to do boasting basically, by going with a pal for a lovely little trip in Connemara and swimming in the Atlantic.
Wow, how lovely. Was it very, very cold?
Yes, it was extremely cold. And I have to say, as we were in, I mean, we weren't in for an hour's swim, let me just put it like that. But we did better than the briefest of dips. We did stay in for a little while. And you just looked back at the beach. It was a beautiful, beautiful day. And it hasn't been beautiful, beautiful day. So we had very, very good luck. And we looked back at the beach and you just saw people in hats and coats and mufflers and boots. And we were the only people in the sea.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've just got to do these some things sometimes when you're middle-aged, don't you? Just to prove it's all still, you know, you can still do it.
Well, the only time I've been swimming, I'm not sure if we were in the Atlantic or the Irish Sea, she said, geographically challenged. The Atlantic.
Well,
or
tell
the
me
other
where
one.
You were. Were you basically were you on the left or the right of Ireland?
Well, we were in the west. So we were near Cork and Bantry.
Well, that's they're kind of all mingling a little bit there.
Okay,
we're in
so I was in twosies. Anyway, the point is that I was quite young, and at that stage, you didn't have an option. I simply remember being just thrown in. You go, oh, it's too cold, I don't want to. So they chuck you in, and then you have a great time and, you know, some chips or something afterwards.
Yeah, basically so that.
I have done it, but it was not of my own volition.
No, well, this was very much of my own volition, and it was very good to feel marvellous and euphoric afterwards, but I did need a big cup of Bovril. So,
what a lovely thing to have on your birthday. If you like that sort of thing, do you think we should tell our international listeners what Bovril is?
Oh, yes, sorry. Yeah,
she means hot beef stock,
yes, basically,
but sort of slightly worse than hot beef stock, I'd say.
And I have to say, I have to be truthful here, I didn't actually get any Bovril because this was a really quite deserted cone.
Right.
It did not have a little kiosk as I had hoped it might. I mean, I love a deserted beach, but when you want a Bovril, you want a Bovril. And I think I'm
want a Bovril.
Maybe it's because my birthday, I'm in sort of nostalgic mood, but that's what you always got after swimming on Sunday mornings, isn't it?
Not me, mate. I'm aware of it. I find it disgusting, but I know that there are people who like it. So you do you. It's your birthday.
Should we move on to matters more intellectual, do you think?
I really do. Well, we're going to talk, aren't we, shortly about the European Writers' Festival, which is in a week and a bit. But we should also mention, it being May, that this is the month of the Hay Festival.
Yes, it is.
It's going to happen, isn't it? We're going to be there. We're going to do a live podcast. And there's lots of TLS events. And you're going to be talking to lots of people, Alex, aren't you? Can you remember
loads of people
off the top of your head?
Richard Flanagan I'll be talking to. Paul Lynch. So that's two Booker Prize winners, in fact. And also Miriam Margolyes.
Oh,
with
wonderful.
Bob Cryer. I will be talking to them too, and some other people besides. And Lucy, I think I'm going to have a slight bit of pleasure here, and another thing for our listeners to conjure up. I think I'll be driving you there, won't I?
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Apart from the punishingly early start, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think I might be driving you there. It'll be a sort of very, very, very literary Thelma and Louise with sort of pick and mix instead of guns.
Less murder.
Yeah, less murder.
A bit less murder. And we've got a packed paper. We've got lots of wonderful things in the paper today. It's one of those ones, I mean, we always think this, but, you know, where you could, you know, we could have done it for 2 hours. But for instance, I know that something that you have read and, in fact, talked to the author, we've got a review of Enlightenment by Sarah Perry in this week.
Oh, I look forward to reading that because I hugely enjoyed it and found it very, very impressive. I love Sarah Perry's writing. And so I look forward to reading the review. And also, in fact, the fiction section is full of things that are right up my street because there's a review of Rupert Thompson's How to Make a Bomb, and he's one of my favourite novelists. So I'm delighted by that. Okay. And indeed, a piece which touches on, among other writers, Andre Kurkov, who I know we're going to be talking about later. So there's all sorts of things and lots of surrealism.
Lots of surrealism. There's also a brilliant piece, a review of a book called Women and the Piano. There's a very good piece on that as well, which I can recommend.
What does it say about women and the piano?
Women have a long and special relationship with the piano. There's been obviously lots of wonderful lady pianists. But you'll be perhaps not surprised to learn that there has been a little bit of sexism involved along the way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really interesting piece, actually. It's brilliant, by Flora Wilson. So it's all good. It's all worth reading.
I wish I'd had you with me, Lucy, because you are very musical. I wish I'd had you with me in the west of Ireland, where I saw music virtually at every turn.
Oh, did you? The sessions in every pub?
Lots and lots and lots of sessions.
Mm. I'm not musical like that. I can't play like they can at all.
No, but you would appreciate it. Oh, I would, it's very, very great fun.
I would have loved it, yeah.
But without further ado, we maybe should get on and with the rest of the podcast. This week, Susan Owens on the life and work of the surrealist Eileen Agar. And Rosie Goldsmith, curator of the European Writers' Festival, joins us to tell us about a weekend of special events.
But first, we're looking at surrealism this week. We have a piece on André Breton, the head boy of surrealism, who, as our reviewer points out, liked to police and patrol this apparently free-spirited movement. And we also have a piece on an artist much less well-known than Breton, but who genuinely does seem to have been a free spirit in art and in her extraordinary life, which is Eileen Agar. Her own memoir has been recently reissued, and Susan Owens has written a piece for us about her. So if you want bouillabaisse hats and beachcombing for Picasso, why wouldn't you? Let's say hello to Susan, who joins us now. Susan, thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, it's a real delight to be here to talk about this.
Well, so since I mentioned the bouillabaisse hat, which you start your review with, could you just tell us what it is? Tell us about it.
It's amazing. It's probably her best known work in her entire career, which was very long. She made it in 1937. Actually, I think there are different versions of it, but it's her ceremonial hat for eating bouillabaisse. She made it out of a cork basket that she picked up in Saint-Tropez. And she painted it blue and then covered it in this fishnet and trimmed the hat with this mermaid's hoard of things that she'd found while she was beachcombing. So coral and seashells. There's a wonderful fish bone that kind of sticks up like a feather and sea urchins. But it's actually very beautiful. She called it herself a sort of Archimboldo headgear for the fashion conscious. Mm-hmm. But it is, there's something, I think it says a lot about her life as well, because she was a very stylish person and very elegant. And it seems to be all about pleasure. I think pleasure is so important. It runs through her entire memoir. But I think that's what this makes this hat so much fun, because it's sort of, it's a strange surreal object, but it's also about a pleasurable experience.
It's completely exactly as you describe it, because I read it in the piece. And naturally, what is the first thing you do in the modern world, especially. You immediately make your go own. And Google it. Yes, right. Second thing you do would be to
make I'm going to make my own.
I know. You yes. Google it and you think, you know, you want to have a look at it. Obviously, you want to have a look at it. Mm. And I was kind of wondering whether it would be almost like a sort of novelty hat, you know, that it would have kind of bits and pieces of, you know, marine life hanging off it. And I wasn't prepared for exactly as you say, how beautiful it is. You think you would just be blessed to wear a hat so beautiful. It's gorgeous, isn't it?
It certainly is very chic. And she made another hat around the same time with the same, I think it's same sort of shape, but made out of straw, with these very, very beautiful Italian leather gloves just crossed over on the hat. So it's made out of these overlapping fingers, but she's painted the fingernails with red nail varnish. And it's this really lovely, lovely, again, extremely elegant object.
In your piece, you have this lovely quote about how she's talking about surrealists, not that she necessarily fully admitted to being one, did she? But this quote about how they see life and art particularly as a kind of wonderful game, and that this is how you play it kind of thing. Do you think, I know the surrealists were supposed to be, as I was saying, you know, free-spirited and all of that, but they, I think most of them were not as joyful as her, were they?
You get the impression they probably weren't. I think you're quite right. She was always at a slight tangent to surrealism, that she certainly shared a lot of their ideas, and she loved the idea of delving into the unconscious mind. She loved the idea of sort of chance juxtapositions, and also this sort of wit, the kind of surrealist wit in objects that are quite disparate that could be put together and make another sort of point. She did love all that, but I think she always, throughout her life, she always found her own way of doing things. She never really wanted to tie herself down, whether it was to her family early on, because she left home in her early 20s when her mother was becoming very overbearing. She just left and made it up by herself. And the same with surrealism. She never would have wanted to have been a sort of fully paid up member. She was absolutely delighted to be asked to contribute to this amazing exhibition in 1936 that was held in London, you know, the big international surrealist exhibition. And she was the only British woman who exhibited in that exhibition. But throughout the rest of her life, she said herself, and she says in her memoir, she was as much an abstract artist as a surrealist. And she very much set her own agenda.
Your piece very strongly transmits that sense of her. So this memoir, which was co-written, wasn't it, by Andrew Lamberth, and it was came out quite a while ago and has now been reissued, it does tell, it's an extraordinary life she had, isn't it? Even just at I read a bit about her upbringing in Buenos Aires, which it sounds impossibly glamorous and far away.
It was just, yeah, completely extraordinary. There was immense wealth in the family. Her father was a Scot and her mother was from New England. But they settled in this very wealthy suburb of Buenos Aires because her father ran the family firm of Agar Cross, which was to do with importing goods from the UK to North and South America. So there's an enormous amount of money in the family. And so she grew up with immense privilege. But then when her father retired in 1911, the family decamped to London. But apparently on the voyage on the way from Argentina to England, apparently her mother insisted on having both an orchestra and a cow on board ship because she felt that her daughters absolutely needed fresh milk and they needed to hear music as they were on the voyage. So, which is almost surreal in itself.
Yes, it is. And you could take your own cow and orchestra.
I mean,
with
you know, we have heard, again, in the current world, we have heard of emotional support animals. But this is not a cow on a cruise, is quite a different thing, I had have thought.
You're right, it does sound very surrealist in itself.
Yes, it's almost like that sort of was a good, I don't know, kind of upbringing. It grounded you in curious juxtapositions, I suppose.
Exactly.
Well, exactly. So. Yeah. No, there's another one that you talk about, that she wanted to go to art school, which is not what someone of her position should be doing. And they said, is this right? They said that she could only do it if she went and was picked up in the family Rolls Royce.
Yes, exactly. Delivered and collected again as soon as the class was over. I think what comes out very strongly in the book is this absolute self-belief and a steely determination to get her own way and to avoid confrontation where she can. So she says, you know, at some point rather grandly, something like, I've spent my life in revolt against convention, which is true to an extent, but she had a knack of just quietly getting her own way. And with the Rolls Royce, she just persuaded the chauffeur to drop her off around the corner. So she'd really just go off and do her own thing. As long as her parents were reasonably happy, they allowed her to go to the Slade. They gave their qualified approval for her to go because it seems as though they were still pretty determined that she would marry well and start producing children, neither of which she had any intention of doing at all. So it was this funny in-between stage at the Slade, which was a wonderful place for her to go because it was very progressive socially, that men and women could work together in the life room and swap notes and ideas. But it was also really rigorous training. She was trained by the rather formidable Henry Tonks, and drawing was very central to the way the students learned, not making beautiful drawings, but made drawings that really helped you to understand the human figure as the basis of art.
Mm. And what was her talents like? I mean, where did her greatest talents lie in an artistic sense, I wonder?
I think a lot of it was to do with, well, she worked in various different media, really. I mean, she was a painter. She did a lot with collage. And in a way, you can almost say that perhaps collage was her ideal medium because that was the one that enabled her to sort of put things together. I think she loved found objects, putting found objects together and finding funny rhymes between them. And also sculpture. So in a way, the hat is part of that. But she also made this wonderful work that's just called Marine Object, which is a very ancient Greek amphora that turned up in a fisherman's net in the south of France. And the fisherman gave it to her and she made it into this sculpture by adding other little bits and pieces she'd found on the beach and then a ram's horn from Cumbria. So these disparate objects that work brilliantly well together. She loved beachcombing more than anything, I think, because the sea would, almost in a surreal way, it would take things and it would change them, it would add to them, it would stick sort of seashells onto them, and then it would randomly push them back up onto the shore for her to find and include into her artworks. So, yes, I mean, her paintings are very wonderful and very lyrical, but she had all these different irons in the fire.
Mm-hmm. And you say that in the book she doesn't actually talk about it, or she doesn't sort of talk about the process or the inspiration of it that much, does she? Do you think there's a sort of element of the, also a surrealist idea, isn't it, that it's kind of the unconscious, you don't want to pick it apart too much?
I think that's right, yes. In a way, the tone of her book slightly militates against her going deeply into the way she made her art, because it sort of trips along in this very, very witty, entertaining, very matter-of-fact way. And every now and then she'll pause and say something about her ideas about dreams or surrealism, her ideas about painting. But you get the impression that she always skirts around the subject of how she made her art. And actually, there's a very interesting preface in the book that's written by her niece, and she says, when I asked her about her collages, and this is quite late in life, her replies were always enigmatic, for her process was intuitive, as if the pieces had formed themselves. And it's almost, yes, as you say, it's that surrealist idea of chance and play. She talks about almost immersing herself in this idea of play and letting that guide her work. So I suppose that is ineffable. She can't really get to the bottom of it and describe it.
Mm. I was really struck reading your piece, the quotes that you chose and, you know, everything that you said about her, that I was struck. I was thinking, I'm reading a piece about a female artist who did more or less what she liked. She enjoyed herself. She enjoyed her work, which was pretty wonderful. She held her own in the world and she kept her sense of joy, you know, and I thought, gosh, I can't remember the last time I've read about a female art, or possibly any artist, but particularly a female artist. There was such a palpable sense of joy and play. Did you find that remarkable as well?
afterwards, or when I've been just more recently thinking about the book, I suddenly thought, actually, she doesn't ever complain that not once in the book about being passed over for an exhibition because of her gender or any of those things. It is remarkable. I wonder whether it's partly to do with her family background. I think in a way it's this determination and self-belief. I wonder whether, in fact, that comes from a confidence that comes with money, because money brings freedom.
Yeah, yeah. So she had extreme privilege. Yeah. She didn't have to do any of the sort of day-to-day things, did she?
Not so much. But then when she left home in her early 20s, she had a big row with her mother about her going out to an afternoon concert with her boyfriend. And she was in her early 20s by this time. But her mother said she mustn't go. And they had this big blow up. And Eileen just left and never went back. But at that point, I think life did get much harder. She got a couple of rooms. Her family stopped her dress allowance, which is the one source of income that she had. But she had a bit of money from someone else. So she'd started to sort of pay the rent on that. But it was quite brave of her in a way, because she admits at the time she'd barely ever seen the inside of a kitchen. She didn't know how to cook anything. So she had to sort of learn how to do it. But she just seemed to have, by force of personality, but she had a gift for friendship as well, I think, that she, wherever she went, at art school, before she went to the Slade, she went to the Leon Underwood Art School run by Leon Underwood, and she met Gertrude Hermes and Henry Moore, who became great friends. Wherever she went, she met these artists who became friends, and they helped each other as they went along. It is completely remarkable, but it's partly this, our own sense of personal freedom, which is partly to do with surrealism. And it can partly be seen, I think, in a lot of the motifs she uses in her paintings. She's always painting birds and fish and swimming figures. It's as though she's constantly drawn to these free creatures.
And fluidity, as you say. You say her voice is fluid and gossipy, which is sort of, those two things together, you can imagine them feeding into one another. And all the people that you the help that she gave to other artists and they gave to her. I mean, there is quite a lot of social life in this piece, as you've written about it. I mean, they're really, seeing Salvador Dali and sketching Dylan Thomas. And also, this is me being gossipy, I'm sure, but fending off Evelyn Waugh.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Evelyn Waugh doesn't come out too well out of that.
No,
does he?
He doesn't. So he wanted to renew his acquaintance with her, as she puts it, and she did not want same.
Yes, exactly. Yes, it was where she and the man who would become her second husband were good friends with Alec Waugh, Evelyn Waugh's brother. And so they kept encountering Evelyn Waugh, and Eileen describes him as a sort of, almost as a slightly demonic figure. She says something like, oh, he always just delighted in seeing the worst in everyone. And he was constantly trying to persuade her to go to bed with him. And yes, here we are. He renewed his acquaintance with me by trying to lure, charm, and finally push me into the bushes. But she managed to fend him off.
Yeah, that's what I mean about her spirit and her art. It sounds like it's not as though she did have a very privileged life, but as you say, there were hardships. I mean, there are in any life, and there must have been obstacles. Of course, it's valid for people to struggle and worry and show all of that fight. It just struck me how unusual it is that she just kind of almost, as you say, flies through it or flies above it or just kind of says, I'm going to enjoy things and I'm going to make beautiful things and I'm going to carry on doing that for her whole life, really.
Yes, yeah, that's absolutely central to her life. And as I say, pleasure was such a motivating force, and that includes her work, because I think her work gave her an enormous amount of pleasure. But at one point she says something interesting about the surrealists, and she says something like, oh, they're always supposed to be immoral monsters, but I, for one, did not go to bed with everybody who asked me, when would I have had time to paint? And then she talks about having an affair with Paul Nash and another one with Paul Eluard. But she says, but that was about love. And it was only when she says something like, you know, it's a special attraction, and it's love. But, you know, and that's the thing one should always follow. On the facing page, there's a wonderful photograph of her, which I think says it all, which just entitled Self Dancing on a Roof. And this is on the French Riviera in 1937, when she's on holiday with Man Ray and Picasso and various other people. And she's had to spend a night in a bat infested room. So she's dancing this dance of freedom. She's wearing nothing apart from a transparent dress, but just high above the town on this roof. It's just an incredibly joyful image.
Yeah. So, I mean, you said, got the impression that you got a lot of joy from the book as well.
The book is immensely enjoyable. I don't think I've ever read a book for a review before that I've enjoyed so much. You just don't want it to end. It just kind of whizzes. It whizzes
along.
That is
a recommendation indeed.
It really is. Oh, it really is. And it's fascinating and wonderful to hear about it.
And we are going to go off and make our Bure Base hats, aren't we?
We are.
Yep, and dance on the roof.
And dance on the roof in diaphanous costumes.
Yes, eventually, maybe, yeah. Or it's things warm up a bit more. Exactly.
Thank you so much. That was so interesting.
Good. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for asking me.
Thank you. Still to come on the show, we look forward to a weekend of events celebrating European writing.
And to read all the pieces we talk about and much more, remember to subscribe to the TLS. Just head on over to our website at the-tls.co.uk.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free, wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Well, on the weekend of the 18th and 19th of May, the British Library in London will play host to the European Writers' Festival, a coming together of some of the greatest talents across the continent in a series of interviews and panel discussions. We're delighted to have the festival's founder and curator with us today to explain more. Welcome, Rosie Goldsmith.
Well, how lovely to be here. I feel right at home, I must say, because the TLS is very much my literary home. It's great to be with you.
And I think the TLS is involved in the festival to a degree as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, the first two panels on the Saturday are hosted by me and by one of yours, by Toby Lichty as well. Mm. So, you are one of the partners, and it is a really brilliant fit, I think. And most of the partners we've got, you know, such as Guardian as well, and English Pen and UCL, they are, you know, really enthusiastic partners because they know what we're trying to do, which is, I suppose, basically to take stock of what's happening in European literature and translation in English, because it's all in translation, and really to, I suppose, continue to embed what we all do, all of us, you, Lucy, Alex and I and Toby, make sure that we're still very aware and connected with European trends in literature and translation and across the world. And this is one way of doing it over a very intense and packed weekend, as you can imagine. You know, there are 9 events in one weekend, and there are over 30 writers, and of course lots of translators and publishers and editors and general readers, we hope, as well. And it's all going to happen over one weekend, but so it's, there's no other place, I don't think, anywhere where you can get that many European writers of this caliber and from so many countries in one place, and sort of really catch up with what's been going on in writing in the other part of Europe, as I tend to call it, on the mainland, as opposed to
the main bit.
The main bit of Europe.
Well, it is. I mean, as you've said, it's always been very important to us, the TLS, to cover other languages in the original, but also translation, and to talk about the act of translation and, you know, all of that sort of thing. Can you give us you can't give us a list of everyone who's turning up, because you said there's lots of them.
Are you sure? I can tell you everyone.
Just to do it very, very quickly, Rosie.
Definitely can't speak that quickly. There are, as I say, there are over 30 writers. And, you know, I really don't want to pick out favourites or whatever, because I've chosen all of them. They were all submitted to me by their various institutes or embassies or cultural institutes. And I was able to choose from a list of about 3 of contemporary writers in English translation. And all of it is recent translation. So from, say, the last, you know, last year to about 5 years ago, that's the furthest back it goes. So, you know, you really are getting a feel for contemporary European writing. And the authors I've chosen are really amazing. I mean, sometimes I'm quite shocked at how little we know about what's going on in the rest of Europe. I shouldn't be shocked anymore. I know what we're like in the UK. And in a way, it's even more of a challenge now because we are not in the EU. So, you know, you have to try even harder to be more representative, to keep your eyes and ears open, and to pick the authors you think should not just be, you know, appear at a festival, but should either we should be reading more of. And I think we've made a pretty good selection. I say we, I think I.
I think I've done a pretty good job.
Well, you are the prime mover here, aren't you? And have always been, haven't you? This is your festival.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously there are some wonderful people who are helping, and the British Library has, I've got to say, they've always been so supportive of European literature and all international literatures. I've worked with the British Library on international writing since I left the BBC, so it's over 10 years. And I've chaired all kinds of, you know, we had something called the European Literature Night for nearly 10 years, and that happened once a year. And again, I was, you know, sort of corralling everybody and getting all the cultural institutes and embassies and publishers and so on, translators, to work together. And it is a really collaborative effort. But to have a festival like this, which is only in its second year, and to really already have the kind of recognition we have, I cannot tell you how it warms my cockles, because it's, you know, it isn't an easy time to be doing this in the UK. You know, anything with the word Europe attached is still a little bit difficult to implement and execute, but, you know, it's working and people do want it to happen. So, yeah, I mean, the authors.
We are going to have to get you you don't want to pick favourites, but you are going to have to tell us some of the writers.
Can I just name one of them? Because actually we've got a review of his most recent book in the TLS this week, so it's not picking favourites, I don't think. I know that Andrei Kirchhoff will be there, and the review of his book is in the paper this week.
Yes, now Andrei is somebody I approached very early on. And I do believe in, you know, bringing these really big, great names to our shores still. I know Andre is pretty well known here already, but he is a very, very important voice for all of us, not just in literary circles, but political as well. And it's very important that we, you know, we focus on Ukraine as well. We have two Ukrainian writers. In fact, we have him and we have a wonderful poet as well. And Andre's got two books coming out. So he's got a book of reportage called Our Daily War and The Silver Bone, which you're reviewing, the first in the Kiev Mysteries, which, you know, they're wonderful. He's a wonderful, wonderful writer. And he's going to be interviewed by Luke Harding, who's also a wonderful writer. So, you know, I try very hard to match the authors to the chairs, to the themes and so on. I think that's really one of the great challenges of any festival, is to make it interesting for the audiences. It's not just for me. And the way that I've grouped the authors in the other panels as well, you know, we've got 9 events, as I said, in one weekend, 8 panels, which means there are 3 to 4 authors on each panel. So I've given them all a rough topic to talk about, you know, whether it's, you know, conflict or translation and, you know, so on. There are so many different areas. Travel writing is another really interesting area of European writing. And these authors are coming to us with their, not just with their novels, but with their short stories, with their poetry, with their plays. A lot of writers do several things, as you know. And we have the fantastic Sasha Salzman from Germany, who was born in Russia. And Sasha is a playwright and a novelist, very brilliant novelist, and has written a novel which has just come out. So most of them are quite, you know, recent. Elisa Victoria is a young Spanish writer. Emma Dabiri, you probably know as well, who's Irish Nigerian. And Emma is one of, I would say, a third of the authors who are of mixed heritage. So that's another really interesting aspect of European literature, which people need to take on board, that there are so many different mixtures. You know, we've got our Austrian writer is Japanese Austrian. We have a Hungarian Romanian, you know, we have a Scottish Canadian Indian, I think she is. And we have one of my favorite authors, and I am going to name a favorite here as well, is the Black Italian writer, Igiaba Shego, and her book, The Color Line. She's been writing for over 20 years. I know Italian really well. I know how revered she is in Italy, but she's not well known in this country at all. And The Color Line is her first book to be published in the UK. And she's going to be appearing for the first time at a festival, at our festival. And it's an absolutely wonderful novel, an historical novel. There are lots of historical novels.
Yes, yeah, I saw that there's lots of that going on, isn't there? There's a lot of kind of looking back, not for answers necessarily, but almost like a kind of precursor to what's going on.
There is. And I'm always surprised because, you know, as you say, I do know this world pretty well. I'm always surprised still at how much people are writing about their past and their history, especially, interestingly, a lot of younger women. And I think this is fascinating because in Eastern Europe, you know, we had, after the war fell, of course, we had a lot of authors who hadn't ever really published before, and writing about, you know, what had happened to them under the various regimes. And now we've got a lot of young women writing about their past and about, you know, their mothers and their grandmothers. And I've got about 3 or 4 multi-generational women's historical novels at the festival. I think that's quite an interesting little mini trend because, you know, that's one thing you always try to do is look for the trends. And, you know, that's quite difficult to do, as you can imagine. But there is a lot of very visceral kind of freedom of expression, a lot of writing about sex and gender identity.
Mm-hmm. I was very interested that, I mean, you have got a sort of overall theme, haven't you, Rosie? And it is transformation. And I wondered where that idea came in. Was it just simply from seeing how so many forms and identities and cultures seem to be kind of mutating? Metamorphosing, I wonder.
Yes, I mean, I think it's that. I know it's that. And that's definitely one aspect. But it's also the, you know, looking at Europe and looking at our world and the, absolutely extraordinary acceleration of change. And, you know, how do we keep up with it? How do we express it? How do we articulate it? How do we write about it? You know, how do we make it into something which, you know, we can all understand? And writers are still, you know, they're really amazing. They're still doing that. I still, you know, I admire them so much for trying to formulate what's going on. And that change, you know, war and this awareness of, you know, what's happening politically. And of course, many of them are EU countries. They're not all from the EU, I hasten to add. It is a Europe-wide festival. You know, they've got elections coming up in June. They are thinking differently to the way that we think about Europe. So, you know, that's very much of a theme as well. And it's all about change. It's all about how fast it's all happening and how do we talk about it? How do we write about it?
I guess another one of the interesting things that always comes out of festivals, I find it often if I'm at a festival, talking to writers over the course of a weekend or even longer, the way texts begin to kind of talk to one another across events and the connections that writers start to make with one another. That's always one of the most fruitful of things, aspects of live events, isn't it? Because it's not always something that you anticipate.
Oh, Alex, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's actually the pleasure of it all, really. You know, when you're organising festivals or events or chairing them, as you and I do, you know, you prepare, but the rest is in the lap of the gods. You know, you just want to throw up all the bits in the air and you say, OK, let's see what happens now. Let's, you know, it's all about the magic of the event, because you have no idea what's going to come out when you put a Bulgarian with an Italian with a Slovenian and with somebody from Ireland. You've got no idea. And you hope there will be some kind of, you know, crossover and interaction. There usually is. And it's usually very surprising.
Exactly. Mm.
You also have the audience who come on, and often I find, and I'm not disrespecting, you're both absolutely wonderful interviewers and moderators. But I have found, maybe this is just me, that actually the audience just ask brilliant questions.
Yeah, frequently. Yeah. Particularly great when they ask something and you think, oh, I knew I should have asked that. At least yeah, it's going
it's
to
so
get covered in. It's, yeah, exactly. You kind of lean like, forward and say, I'm so glad you brought that up. And you're thinking, God, I really should have done that. But, you know, it's all going to get covered in that hour or however long. But that's right. I mean, and you know, when audiences are engaged, it's a very special feeling, as they nearly always are.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the aspects of all of this is that, you know, we hope that the audiences will become obviously more informed about what's happening in the rest of Europe and also about, you know, the arts generally and literature and of course, you know, all kinds of other issues come up about translation and language. There's a lot, you know, we end up talking a lot about language, which I found always fascinating. But you know, you hope that something new will emerge from this. There's no point in putting on a festival if something isn't created through the actual fact and the reality of the festival. You know what I mean? You want to, you know, what's the tabloid headline going to be after the festival? You know?
Take home.
What's the take home? I would never say that. I'm a former BBC.
Well, listen, this is what we can ask you. What would you like it to be at the end of this weekend?
Oh, gosh, I really do hope that we can expand the audience for translated literature. I really hope that more than anything. I think the fear factor, you know, came in again, you know, during the pandemic and during Brexit, during that horrible sort of isolated period that we all went through. And it's been very difficult to resuscitate this big embrace, if you like, for the rest of Europe and the rest of the world. In literature and the arts, there are lots of practical problems, as you know, there are lots of funding problems. But I really hope that we can, you know, extend the welcome, the knowledge, and also the love of other literatures.
Do you see signs of that happening? You know, a lot of this is a kind of anecdotal feel, isn't it? But I see people talking about works in translation, and really, you know, following particular authors, reading perhaps the whole of their work, perhaps more than I have done in recent years. It feels, I may be just being over optimistic, but it feels as if there's more coverage, you know, am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm really not too down about it. I think that, you know, if we can continue to fund festivals and gatherings like this, all the amazing festivals that we're all involved in, it really does help, you know, keeps our eyes and ears open. It keeps us, makes us better people. It really does. And I think that, you know, there is an uptake in reading of translated. I know there's an uptake of reading in translation, and a lot of it's happening amongst younger people. And that, I think, is really fascinating as well. It's not, as you know, it's not just the old 3% that we've all talked about in our years of working in books. You know, it's now about 11% of what we read
is
in
it?
Fiction.
That's
in the
brilliant
UK. It's absolutely amazing. And yeah,
you know, the 3% was very depressing, but now if that's no longer, if that's definitively no longer true, that's terrific.
That's definitely not the case anymore. And it is a lot, you know, thanks to young people, but it's also a lot thanks to manga and Japanese translation. I'm not saying it's all, you know, it's not all European, but it is all the same mix. You know,
yeah,
there are,
of course,
as I say, there are younger people, there are more men as well reading translated fiction. It used to be one of those things you just sort of think of women, you know, doing it, and but no, it's it is fascinating. And of course, there are so many more independent publishers. In spite of the difficulties of publishing and funding anything, they are still going at it, and they are just opening so many opportunities and doors for people who want to write and, you know, want to translate. So long may that continue.
Well, Rosie, we can't wish you more luck with it. It sounds wonderful. You've got not very long to go now. Still some last minute touches, or you just, is it all done now and you just now need to relax before it kicks off?
Oh, Alex, relax.
I know. I just
silly
put
question.
It out there.
I mean, silly, silly
there.
Question. I think I'm, you know what, I'm really quite cool about it all. I can do what I can do. And, you know, we all do work very hard. I do, as I say, have wonderful, you know, have a handful of wonderful people working with me, the various European institutes and cultural institutes and embassies and so on, and booksellers and publishers. You know, everybody is now at this stage where, you know, they know that this is great and they want to make it happen. So yeah, we're fine. We'll get there. There are hiccups, of course there are, but that's fine. We can deal with them.
We wish you huge luck. It sounds like it's going to be a wonderful celebration. And of course, now you better tell us how people actually come along. Where do they get tickets, etc. from?
They come along for the weekend. As I say, it starts Saturday morning and goes through till Sunday late afternoon, early evening. And they can get tickets from the British Library website. And so it's the European Writers Festival British Library website. The tickets are incredibly reasonable. You can get a day ticket or you can get a weekend ticket, and you can go to as many or as, you know, few of the events as you want to. But hopefully the whole idea of the festival is that people, you know, start in the morning and end in the evening because they just want to be there and they're gripped. I hope that'll be the case.
Thank you so much for coming and telling us about it today, Rosie.
It's lovely to talk to you both. Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Susan Owens and Rosie Goldsmith.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.